Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I have to inform you that I'm, since you mentioned doing philosophy around improv, that I am an actual philosopher, so it could become more philosophical than you ever expected, which might be a good thing or
what
not.
What does that mean that you're a philosopher? Like, what do you have a degree in?
I have a degree in philosophy.
Yeah. And technically, do you actually use it?
Well, the thing that that studying philosophy gives you is primarily the, hopefully, the ability to argue, to use logic, and to think scientifically, if I could just make a bottom line. So,
sure.
Like learning who said what when was never too interesting to me. I was more interested in the concepts themselves and thinking and investigating things and figuring out how things work. I was leaning pretty much towards sciences regarding that. I was, I think in the US I would belong to the arts as a philosopher, right?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like different schools put it in different sections. You know, it depends on the way the curriculum works. If the university you went to set it up in a science way, then hey. You know, might argue it's just the education.
We have two different brands for science. There are sciences of nature, like physics, biology, chemistry, you name it. And there are what should translate as sciences of the mind, which are history and philosophy and languages. And in between, there are the empirical sciences, like psychology, for example.
Okay, cool. So I was going to ask where psychology fell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Empiricists.
Sure.
they look down on theorists like me, usually.
Oh, sure. Yeah, those people with practical facts, yeah. They're so mad. If you can't show me exactly how it works, then I'm not interested in believing it's a thing. I know how it
exactly.
is. Yeah.
But I have sympathy for that. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. It makes sense. If that's the way they need to see it. I mean, you teach improv, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you perform improv? Or both?
Oh, both. Both, yeah.
Great.
And
well,
I,
you know,
and I
then... Go ahead.
And I teach improv not only for the stage, also applied improvisation for people who stand in front of other people or teams who want to perform more efficiently, like at work, basically,
yeah.
in a corporate environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, both of those are very helpful. And what I was going to say was that there are students, some of whom receive the information just on, you know, suggestion. You say, this is how this is going to work for you. And they go, I believe it. And then they go forward. And some people are like, show me. I need to see it. And the tough thing with improv, it's hard sometimes. And the beauty of exercises is you can create an exercise to show a specific thing. So it's like, see how it was simple for you to do this and that, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's funny how that is that, you know, some people's brains just really need you to show them. They need to see it in front of their eyes or else they won't believe it.
That's one of the reasons why why I focused on brains, so I can explain people why an exercise needs to be funny, for example, why they need to have fun for it to work. Absolutely. I agree. That's how people are wired. I wanted to say something and I forgot it, so let's just.
Okay, cool.
No, I'm going to beach volleyball afterwards.
Oh my God, I love that's the
I'm
best thing I've
serious.
ever heard.
What? That's the what? The what stuff?
That's the best thing I've ever heard. What a great.
What,
So
beach
I'm going to
volleyball?
finish this interview with you and then I'm going to go do beach volleyball. Awesome. Who does
Why
that?
wouldn't I?
That's so great. Of course. It's just in my mind, I have no idea. Like for me, it's 9 in the morning. I don't know. It's been raining
What?
for weeks in Austin, so the sun hasn't been out in forever. So
Oh
I'm
my
like,
God.
oh, tell me about the
Here in Germany, we have had the driest summer in history. It has been raining like, I don't know, 3 days the entire
Wow.
summer. It was
Whoa.
sunny, 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 sunny. It wasn't the hottest, but it was the driest summer since 1840 something. Just
Goodness.
saying. But I bet in Austin it's more like in Saudi Arabia when they walk out when it's raining, when finally they can get some rain on their skin. No?
No, that's true for sure. The number one thing people in Texas like to say when you complain about the rain is, well, we needed it. You're like, ugh, fine. It's like, okay. But did we need it all in the one day? Like, couldn't we have spread it out over, a little bit a day for 3 months as opposed to just pouring water directly onto my lawn and now there is a humongous lake and then it soaks up, but it still was a lake for a while, you
The
know?
trick is to get out early enough when it starts raining so you can still enjoy the petrichor. That's the name of the smell of rain that touches very dried out ground, when you can sort of smell the rock and the stone and the street. It has a very particular smell, and that's called petrichor.
Wow.
Boosh. Ha
Man,
ha,
you're
I
smart.
just mansplained you.
I don't know.
And not for the last time.
I don't know that you can necessarily count that mansplaining when I don't know anyone of any gender that knows that. That is some serious information. Petrichor, what a wild word. Oh my God. And how specific the smell of rain on dried out ground. Like what? You're amazing. All right. So, I need to know what you know about the brain because I
Hour.
wonder you mentioned that you're interested in, the way the brain works with reference to this kind of stuff, and I wondered, did you study neuroscience, like specifically brain science, or is this sort of postgraduate studies that you've done on your own since incorporating philosophy and improv together?
Both in my master's degree included was the I could either have a regular minor as a subject, or I could connect different subjects for my thesis. And in that particular period, our university put together biologists, sociologists, psychologists, and philosophers who would offer seminars for all those four groups of students together in order to pin down what the brain does and how those different approaches towards the brain work. And that was very interesting and very synergetic. And I was very curious about the brain back then. So yes, I have the basic background that neuroscientists would also have, but the details I had to collect myself, and I did so over years. Also, my books refer to the latest neuroscientific stuff I can find and which I consider relevant for improv or creativity or spontaneity.
That's
So
so
the
great.
answer is both.
So I have been pseudoscience-ing people and telling them that there is an improv part of your brain. Am I lying to them?
Well, yeah, in a way, because like there's this myth of the two hemispheres, right? Everyone has heard it. It's like this, people are only using 10% of their brain myth that has been around ever since Scientology touched the planet. Both are wrong. So we have two brain hemispheres, but they work in a very similar way, and are almost mirroring each other. While there are some global tasks that are distributed asymmetrically over the brain hemispheres, like language, but complex tasks like speaking, playing improv, being creative are so demanding on multiple layers that the brain has to connect a variety of abilities, of competences that have to be synchronized in order to fulfill them. And that's not possible by just one tiny part. As a rule of thumb, you could say that the more specific something is, and the more you can narrow it down, the more likely there is a tiny part of the brain that is specialized on that. And the more global and more flexible and open a task is, the more of the brain is included. So there are tiny parts of the brain that allow you to see or remember or dream color. For example, there's a very tiny fraction of the area fusiformis in your temporal lobe that is specifically designed to give you the experience of the color red or green or you name it, or to recognize a car, or to tell what brand it is, or what a human is and what a building is. Or there are is a very tiny area in the brain for doing basic math, like multiplication or addition.
Sure.
But
Wow.
the most interesting things we do are connections of competencies that have to be directed in a way. That's one of the reasons why when you have a stroke, language is almost always affected, because language is something that is spread over the entire brain. There are at least three big regions who are mainly busy giving you the ability to speak, which is the Broca area and Wernicke area and the right hemisphere frontal lobe. I don't know how deep you want to go into that, but
I'm fascinated. Everything you're saying is amazing.
there's not one particular part of the brain that makes you creative or that allows you to improvise. While there are specific brain areas who can prevent you from being creative or from improvising, because we have a censoring mechanism which is tightly connected to those regions that manifest what people expect from us. So we anticipate what people will think about us and what people's expectations are. That's the neuroscientific equivalent of what Freud would have called the Über-Ich. I don't know how you translate Über-Ich. So your
I think that's
parents
just how
told you,
what we call it.
your parents told you, do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And in order for you to anticipate what you will be rewarded and punished for. You implement what they will say, what their comment on your actions will be, so they don't have to punish you all the time. You learn it. You manifest this in your brain. And mostly our behavior is restricted and not necessarily encouraged when your parents raise you. They tell you what not to do, and then they might encourage you to do things. These functions have a kind of emergency brake, and they can interrupt whatever you intend to do until a very short time before it's executed. And we're talking about 50 milliseconds before something you intend doing is executed. So very, very shortly before you actually do something, you can still decide, no, I made up my mind, I'm not going to shoot that gun, for example.
Man, what a wild thing, like how little time, like how quickly your brain could potentially make a decision like that.
Yeah. Oh, your brain makes thousands and ten thousands of decisions, if you will, per second. Because it's brains don't work like the computers that we are building right now. We're starting to build microchips that work like neural networks, but that's not on a very high level yet. IBM is doing that, and Intel is doing that as well. But typically, computers work very differently than brains. I don't know if you want to go down that road, but...
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you have used some of this information in the books that you've written about improv. Mm-hmm. What information, like, without giving away the book, of course, what parts of what you learned about the brain are you bringing into your discussion of improv?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm not saying too many things that are necessarily new for experienced improvisers. I just give them the explanation why it is the way they have figured out decades ago. So that you have to leave your comfort zone. That is a basic wisdom, and that you have to be playful, and that you have to be mindful and aware, and that you have to drop your ego to a certain extent in order to be able to improvise. These are all common rules and common wisdoms, and now neuroscience is catching up and can show in the brain what things are happening, or which regions light up and which regions dim when we improvise, when we're being spontaneous. There are very fascinating studies about that. So mainly it is about giving up control. When they made experiments with psychedelic drugs and measured brains of people who took them, they assumed that because people have these bizarre and colorful experiences, that there has to be a lot of action inside the brain. And what they know now is that activity actually is lower when you're on LSD or psilocybin, but it changes the way your brain works. There's a function in your brain that is called the default network, and this is very closely associated with your concept of a self, or an ego, or your personal story and your perspective, the point where all your perceptions run together so you can make one thing out of it. so you can experience from one perspective, both as a person and in matters of 3D exploration of your environment. So usually, many parts of your brain will report to a sort of relay station in the middle, and there are several relay stations really, as far as we know. And what those drugs do is they somehow make those reporting regions connect to each other directly rather than reporting to the boss, to narrow it down a bit. And this is also what makes you have these what's the word again? language barrier. Sorry, I'm trying to think of it
Totally
in
fine.
German.
You're
And
talking about huge
when
concepts.
you hear colors, that, when you hear colors, that's called as I'll have it
Oh,
in a
what
minute.
is it called? I know what you mean, though. So you're
No,
hearing colors. I
I
can't even
just
think of it in English
I don't know.
or
It's just a whole
Latin. I
way
don't know.
I can't believe that I forgot the word. Whatever.
It's okay. The audience
I'm
knows. They've
too
already
excited.
looked it up. It's fine.
It will come to me as soon as I relax. So, because those tiny functional areas talk to each other, they translate what they get from the others in their own language. So if my function as a brain area is to produce sound and I get color information, I will try to translate it into sound, right? Which normally
Synesthesia.
would happen. Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mike. I'm going, S-s-s-s-s-s-s-s. Yeah, thank you very much, my God. Yeah. There we are. So,
Write that down. Oh, synesthesia.
and you don't have to go as far as dissolving yourself, like the brain function of yourself, to improvise. But there's also, as I mentioned, your ego, which is anticipating what people want from you and protecting your social status. And if you get rid of that one, at least for a moment, that is very, very, very helpful in every artistic encounter, whether you write, paint, perform, dance, whatever your thing is. If you really want to dive into it, then you want to get lost in it. And getting lost in something always means getting rid of your ego and just being the thing that you do. The ancient Greeks already knew it, and they called it ecstasis, which is being outside yourself. And they can show it, not the Greeks, but a neuroscientist can show it in the brain that these areas dim down once people get lost in an experience or lost in something they do. Like when you have children who are very good at this, when they play with cars or play an entire city or they play with puppets, what is going on in their brain is not, I'm a 4-year-old boy steering a car around an imaginary corner. They go, ah! They manifest it. They manifest the entire scene with how it sounds, what it smells like, how the car will drift, what the people inside the car will think. There's everything of that scene inside their mind, but not they themselves. They don't think I'm a child playing. They just see the scene. And
You know,
that's
when
what
I'm
happens.
talking to students,
This
I'm always talking about how children are more attuned to that kind of stuff than
Yes.
adults. Yeah, it's
Yes.
harder to like let go of your ego when you're older.
Exactly. And the point is, it's not that they have something that we lost as adults, they miss something that we have as adult, which is an ever active ego. Children don't have social status. They are in matters of social status, they are like pets. Everyone loves them. Everyone tells them what to do. Everyone wants to protect them, but they don't have a say. This starts growing when they become adolescent and they want to show everyone that they can judge too and that they can have an opinion and make informed decisions and become part of society. And as soon as they start proving that they are a member of society, they become aware that they are judged by what they do. And this self-awareness is a pretty strong and important engine for adults. And I'm not taking it away from them. I just show them that there is a lever that allows them to switch it on and off again. So they can play and act and learn freed from that. And then when they leave the workshop or the seminar, they can switch it on again and be functional parts of society again and fulfill the things they've promised and be reliable and everything. Yeah, so that people can count on them. But they,
Mario, wow, you have answered so many questions that I've had about improv and the brain. Oh, this is so great. Oh, you're amazing.
Oh. You're flattering me.
I'm so excited. Okay, so I've made you go super science this whole time. So let me bring it back to art, okay? So you are this, you know, genius philosopher. You're in school. You're studying all this stuff. You've got programs that are helping you as a philosophy master's student learn all the details of neuroscience with all these other teachers. And what a cool program that sounds like it was. But how did you go from studying science into the arts? Because clearly you're very involved in theater now, right? So I wonder how you got from one to the other. What happened?
It was all a big accident. There were these posters at our university reading Improvisationstheater in a very, very strange typography, so it looked as if it were meant to be boring. I had no idea what improv was back then or that it even existed, and I imagined, okay, so there are people who have seen their Hamlet so often that they are terribly bored by it, so the actors need to insert some changes to the piece so you can have a very, very elaborate discussion after the meaning of these changes after you've seen Hamlet for the 32nd time, right? That's how I imagined it. And and I was like, yeah, I'm not sure if that is something for me. And then a friend of mine asked me whether I knew this improv ensemble. And with my already built opinion, my non-informed opinion, I was like, oh, no, I don't think this is something that would interest me. And she goes, what? This is so funny. It's so much fun. It's just go there. You will love it. And I
God
and I
bless
did.
The friends who insist.
Yes. And I went there. I watched it 3 times. And there's a specific scene in my mind is as short as these boomerang things you can have on Instagram. Like, it's almost a screenshot of my colleague. It's actually Roberto who enters the stage on the party guessing game as the animal, and I see this and I hear my own thought, shit, I have to go there, that's my thing. And I realized they gave workshop. I attended one, and of course, with the mouth I have, they quickly recognized me as someone who is potentially extrovert. invited me, and it took forever until they let me on stage. But yeah. And now I'm the only person who is in both improv ensembles that are here in town.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm the artistic director of one of them. And part of the business ensemble of the other one as well.
Oh, wow. What are the
So
names of the
it does that.
two theaters?
There is Theater mit beschränkter Hoffnung. That's where everybody started. It translates as Theater Hope Limited, or Theater with Limited Hope. And the other is Impro Theater Konstanz, which translates as Improv Theater Konstanz. And one was born out of the other. So three, four people left a few years ago to build their own ensemble, trying to do improv in a way that the conservative side of the other ensemble wouldn't allow. So now we have two ensembles and a greater variety of improv in town, which I appreciate.
You mentioned that it took a while for them to let you on stage. Is that the standard setup in the community? Like, take a bunch of classes, earn being able to be on stage, and then, people who have taken a bunch of classes, that's who's the performers?
Every ensemble does that in different ways.
Okay.
The particular ensemble I'm talking about was incredibly lucky in the middle years. We've just celebrated our 25th anniversary, so
Which
it's
one?
been a, the TMBH, the Theatre Hope Limited.
Oh, okay.
So they're there for 25 years now, and they had a statistically unlikely flood of super talents flooding in over many years, and they would just attend 3 or 4 rehearsals and maybe do a 1 day workshop and then just figure out what the idea behind improv is, and then be amazing entertainers and great improvisers from minute one on stage. It's just a very, very luxurious, how do you even say that word?
Whatever way you'd like.
A nice situation to have. So that ensemble never had to focus very much on teaching people the details because they were so good. It's just very amazing. Those people are now professors and doctors and lawyers and whatnot. They're just smart people,
Wild. Now
means very, very.
is that the one that you're the artistic director of?
Yeah, or to say I was until this summer. I think I handed it over. Yeah, but I was for, oh, I don't want to lie, 3 or 4 years now, ish, roughly.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So you went there, you took classes, you got on stage, and then somehow found your way to being the big man in charge. How did that happen?
I don't even know. It's not that I was aiming for that. I mean, some people really are competitive or seek power
Sure.
or try to design things. It's not that I was looking for that, but I was very active as an improviser, and I came around a lot. I've seen many stages and been to many festivals all over the world. Sharna Halpern invited me over to her house because she was so excited about my performance in London. Show off part. So it came in naturally that I imported stuff that I've seen somewhere else to our rehearsals. And yeah, so
What
yeah.
happened at Sharna Halpern's house? I mean, if you don't mind sharing.
Hello.
I mean,
You're
if it's
mostly
you can
playing with
say
her dog.
don't, yeah. What?
Mostly playing with her dogs. She has she always has several dogs, and I think she's getting them from shelters to give them a nicer life. And yeah, her house is big enough to have several dogs, and yeah, she loves caressing and feeding dogs,
Sure.
apparently.
Why not? I mean, they're lovely and they don't talk back, so that's nice.
Yeah.
That's funny. Wow. So tell me about when you first got involved in it. Like, what about improv really got you going? What sparked your interest? Kept you not only performing and having a good time? I mean, because just the details of what you've said so far, you've done so much more than just take an improv class. You took an improv class, you worked your way up to perform, you worked your way up into the business of the theater, which is a totally different kind of situation, but you still were like, I'm interested and let me see it. And you're writing books on the subject. Clearly, you were bitten by the bug and loved it and were like, yes. Let me do this. What happened? How did it?
Absolutely. I just realized that a very big part of me was activated by this arena of possibilities, and a very big part that just hadn't been relevant or I almost want to say accepted before. It was a way I could walk that dog to keep that image up. It's more like it's not something that I did. It's always been something that is happening through me, as if like the only reason to do it myself is so that you are as close to the process as you can possibly be, because you're inside of it, and you always get you also on top of the great scene, you get to feel and think what the person who is involved feels and thinks simultaneously. So it was never something I did. It was something that was happening to me, as if the scene was playing me, as if I were a cello, the scene would play on me, and I would listen to the sound that is coming out of myself. And I was surprising myself over and over again, and also the things that I learned. I mean, I'm saying that they didn't let me on stage for quite a while, and that was for a reason, because they thought that I'm a complete idiot. I was a nerd back then, with no social skills or hardly any social skills. There was a clown inside of me, but he was good at handling people,
It was
and it took
Dr.
forever
Clown,
until
so it
they
was tough.
And just for finally learning social skills and being able to behave in a way that allows people to accept me in being near to them was worth the time already, even if there hadn't been all these amazing stories and people and guests and songs and musicals. And I would like I'm from a family that is less into music than any other person, any other family on the planet. Nobody who's related to me even knows anyone who is into music, who's even listening to music. Like they not only are they incapable of singing even a single note, play an instrument or anything. They barely listen to music, and if you had told me that I would be singing in a room with people back then, I would have laughed. And if you had told me that people will pay tickets in order to see me sing on stage an improvised song to improvised music where I don't even know what the person at the piano is playing, and I would have just I would not have believed it. And now I
What does
do,
your family say
which
when
is.
they see you perform, or do they not get involved?
Oh, like they've seen me perform a handful of times, maybe, I guess, and they liked it. But they're, I think they're also not necessarily theater people. I mean, they enjoy it when they're there, but it's not like they are petting their interests. It's not like they would look up what they can do to entertain themselves. They're not looking for concerts or, as I said, they're
Sure.
not even listening to music. Right?
Yeah, that's
So they're
wild.
not cultural people. But I think what they claimed is they liked it. So and I guess they were pretty much astounded as well that I would sing on stage. And the good thing about
Sure.
improv is you can risk anything. The worst thing that can happen when you sing a song and you're in it with all your heart, the worst thing that can happen is that everybody's laughing, which is still which is still something that many improvisers yearn for,
Oh,
making the
yeah.
audience laugh. Yeah.
Absolutely. Wow.
Oh,
So
so many
how did you
topics.
get back? So it found a way to help you. You know, you got through it. It got you connected with the social scene. It got you maybe out of the super science brain school stuff that you had going on. Those words don't all together go together. It's okay. But wow, how did you get so now? How did you get from being a performer to teaching and writing books about it?
Yeah, I don't even remember how that teaching started or where or when. It's just
It's fine. You don't have to tell all the stories. But what about
it
the
just
books?
came bit by bit. So I think the first we had improv courses back then, like the very first trials of regular weekly based improv classes for interested people. And I think it started with me taking offering single courses, or I think I was the someone couldn't make it on Monday and I had to assist and do the course for them. And then I had my own course, my own class for a while, and then I went to teach ensembles in other places, and I guess that's how that started. I mean, that's a quadrillion years ago, and my memory is not a shelf, it's a bag. So I
How
remember
many years ago
everything, but I
was
don't know
it?
when
Like,
to
how
read.
many years have you been doing improv?
I started improvising in 2004,
Okay.
so I guess, yeah,
14
I guess
years?
that's. That's not how far my memory goes then.
Fine.
Yes, so it's a bit like these those business improv things. I stumbled into that. I have two colleagues who are 5 and 10 years ahead in that process. They have sort of created that job. Of assisting corporations in conferences and trainings and alike contexts. And of course they needed people to perform there, and they booked me. That's how that started. And I figured out that the other part isn't that complicated either. So I started offering that as well. And now the network that exists here is finding a common roof. So we're putting one net into the water together. and have one brand instead of 10 different brands when booking each other. Does that make sense? Any?
Yeah, so you and your other friends who do the business improv have decided to work together as opposed to trying to be individuals all trying to get the same job?
Exactly. And the thing is, we've booked each other anyway. So you normally would need several people for a gig. So one time I would book the other three, and the next time one of those would book the other three. And yeah. And the network grew, like we're spread all over Germany and Switzerland. So we know where people are that we can work with, and what they are interested in and what they are good are at. So yeah, I really enjoy when I can go on stage with people I barely know, and afterwards the audience tells us we know how close you are and how well you know each other. You are a very tight team. And then you tell them, I haven't known them yesterday. I just got to know them when they entered the room. And
Yeah.
that's what baffles people. And then you can say, I can teach you working with people on that level, not knowing them as well
Yeah.
as a team. You don't have to improvise a Shakespeare piece. You can also create new software or a vacuum cleaner working that way.
Yeah.
And
No, that's so great.
there's a big trend in especially technology sector to rearrange entire branches to work agile or Scrum, which is the scaled up version of agile, so people can be creative and more productive.
Yeah.
If you and what they basically do is they break up the hierarchy, they give people a certain amount of time, space, and resources, and let them run. And whenever they need help, they support them, but they let them run and do whatever they need to in order to get a prototype running within, say, 20 days.
Sure. Wow.
And people are creative by nature as soon as there are two conditions. A, people allow them to be creative. And B, they allowed themselves to be creative. And if you add a purpose on top of that, skaboosh, you have a creativity cake.
Skaboosh.
I just made that up.
That's the
The
best word ever. Skaboosh.
creativity cake. Skaboosh, yeah.
Is that an
I
actual
like
word?
that. Not in the languages I know. But I
Fine.
think it's
We have different
onomatopoeic.
languages.
There must be a language where skaboosh is a word. It's
Oh,
so
probably. I hope it doesn't mean something terrible. Sorry, audience, if it
so
turns out in
cozy.
your language it's terrible. We didn't mean it. We meant it in this lovely way.
Get your skaboosh off my balcony.
That's so great. I really love that idea. The idea that you're working with these, people that are trying to create new technologies, and that the improv helps them to work better together to achieve that. Like, that's so cool. Whenever I teach corporate improv workshops, it's usually the groups tend to be sales-based, like real estate. I do a lot of real estate or, a company that everyone's selling, what was it, coupons one time. There's like a coupon company that I don't even understand what they do. I don't understand what any of the businesses do. I just go in and go, let me tell you about improv. But it is fascinating to see how different kinds of companies, because you have to imagine that these people, when they got into their industries, their brains worked a certain way, and I mean that colloquially, not actually officially, because you're the neuroscientist, not me, but you know, like, they work in a specific way. They've been in this industry, they've gotten used to the way that the managers work and the other stuff and the way the paperwork they have to fill out and all this other things that are going on. So it must be nice for you to swing in and shake it up and make them, you know, figure out a brand new and exciting way to achieve their tasks.
Absolutely, and that's not even the only way to use improv. I've worked with people who suffer from dementia, and with people who deal with people who suffer from dementia, and that helps a lot as well. I've been on stage with people who have dementia, and I've been on stage for 2.5 years now. With an ensemble that is integrative, meaning that all of them have different mental conditions. Most of them have Down syndrome, and yeah, if you have the improv attitude, the basic mindset of openness, and that the other person is okay the way she or he is, you can work with everybody who wants to. It's easier for people to work with you, and it's easier to build something when you actually listen to what the other person is saying.
Fascinating. Yeah. Wow. So, final thing I want to talk to you about, because we're rounding out on the hour, but what is your, I know it's almost done, tell me about your performances. Like, you're talking about how you're doing, you know, business work, and you're writing books to help people, help, you know, experienced improvisers understand the way their brains are processing stuff, but for you, what is your exciting performance? What's the thing that you love performing? What's the show that you do regularly that you're so that you that excites you? What's mm-hmm. that part?
So most improvisers who know me would describe me as a physical improviser. So I'm using my body a lot. So as you will know, being in your head is a very well-known term in improv, and many improv teachers will tell you not to be in your head, which is a negative term and therefore difficult for you to implement as a strategy. And the way I deal with it is telling people where to go, which is inside their body and inside into their perception. And I myself try to feel the scene and my body and my emotions rather than think too much. Thinking comes into improvisation when you want to build stories, when you need an arch, when you need to come to an end for a scene or a story. Then you need some intuition or strategic thinking, but before that, there's barely any reason to think anything at all. You just switch your body, you become somebody or something else, and then let it take care of itself. And that's something that the audience and myself enjoy very much, because they feel that you're not in control. You're not with your foot on the brakes. You just let it happen and then deal with it. And that's something that's totally fascinating for the audience, regardless how old they or young they are, because they feel it's real, that you're giving up yourself, and that they can enjoy this freedom that they maybe don't dare living in their real lives. And things can happen on stage, even terrible things can happen, but it doesn't matter. It's like Wile E. Coyote being smashed by a rock, and a second later, he's back again,
Yeah.
suffering again, right? So you're immortal, and people can feel free through your freedom, allowing yourself to become something different and to let go. So I would say my show is one that is consists of a very big variety of beings. So my solo program was called The Thousand Faces of Mario M. So yeah, my approach is going through the body, even when I teach people who stand in front of other people who perform or teach or give keynotes. I always go over the body.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Really, you've really helped me to sort of reconfigure in my brain, like, ways to explain improv to students. I often teach early improvisers. I'm the queen of Improv 101. I love my new people, and I love explaining what improv is from the ground up. But I loved your example of Wile E. Coyote. Like, of course, exactly. What a perfect improv character. One of the things I also like to say, because, you know, we're all kind of stuck in a narrative bent sometimes, is I'll say, you don't need to learn any lessons. Your character doesn't need to become a better person. They just need to keep doing the thing they're doing. Wile E mm-hmm. doesn't, like, figure out new and different ways to try to hurt the Roadrunner. He just keeps trying. He doesn't mm-hmm. learn anything from it. He just keeps trying. And I was like, that's such a perfect, perfect example of a character.
Yeah, and how bold his decisions are.
Yeah.
How bold his decisions are.
And they get bigger and bigger. So they follow like three beats of heightening. Like, it gets crazier and crazier. By the end, he blows himself up, and until he's just a puff of smoke with eyes. And then all of a sudden there he is again. You're right. Man, that's so fun. You said The Thousand Faces of Mario M. Is that a solo show? Does that mean you do that by yourself?
I did. I'm not doing that at the moment. That is the one thing that challenged me in to a degree that improv in front of an audience challenged me when I was a beginner, like in the first, say, one and a half or the first 2 years. I wouldn't even notice the audience because I was so excited being on stage and so nervous and so into it. And you, over the years, you build up a bigger comfort zone. And to get the initial excitement, you have to get out of that one again. And performing as a duo is like riding a bicycle. You have two wheels. And once you go downhill, you can just let it roll and watch the general direction. And you have the time, you can relax. And when you are a solo performer, the eyes are on you at all times. So you can never just roll. It's like a mono wheel that you're on. You have to turn the wheel continuously. And that makes it, I find, very exciting. And then telling different stories parallel and jumping between half a dozen or a dozen characters, that's just very much fun.
What a great journey you've had. And I really appreciate that you've shared that with me. Yeah, I mean, and it continues. You're just getting better and things are more exciting. Thank you so much for sharing your story with me and teaching me so many things about, you know, the brain, and it's just really, it's answered a lot of questions that I had that I didn't realize I had until we had this conversation. So I'm so glad that I got to talk to you today.
Thank you very much, especially for getting up early so you could interview someone who lives on the other side of the planet.
Oh, well, it's not that early. I have a one-year-old baby, so I was up for 2.5 hours before I called you. So,
okay.
I, in fact, am glad that my husband is home because I put the baby in for a nap for us to have this conversation, and the baby has decided he does not want to nap. So I've been hearing in the background my husband trying to convince the baby to take a nap. It's not working out. But that's okay because I'm locked up in the home studio and no one will ever know that I'm in here. Just kidding. I'm happy to get up and I'm happy to chat with you. And the fact that, you know, I want you to go out and have some great beach volleyball right now, like, and enjoy the rest of your day. And please send me, you know, send me all the links when your new website is up. Awesome. Send me links to your book, whether it be in German or English. Doesn't matter. People will read it and, you know, we'll spread the word so that, you know, you get more supportive audience members watching you do your shows and maybe more businesses calling you, needing your help. I mean, if I listened to this conversation and was like, I wonder if this guy's qualified to help me be a better team member. Ooh, wow. I would say, sign him up, get him in here. What's going on? So I hope that you are doing more workshops for people who are fascinated by this.
That's how we're going to do it. It was a pleasure. I love your positive attitude and your welcoming character. That felt really good. I'm honored and pleased. I wish we could talk more often, but your schedule is apparently very, very full.
There's a lot of interviews coming up, audience. Don't you worry. There's a lot of excitement.
Yeah.
Yeah, so feel but free, hey, you know,
to get in touch anytime. I might molest you on Facebook from time to time. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a new book coming out, please let me know. I'd love to help spread the word for you. Or if there's some other adventure that happened, that happens to you, that you're like, oh my God, I need to share this with the world. Tell me, we can do another one. As far as I'm concerned, I'm always happy to talk to people as many times as they'd like to. Right now, I haven't done any revisits, but I was thinking about doing it with like a few of the people that I interviewed really early on. Because a couple were like friends of mine who lived in Austin with me, but now they live in Los Angeles and they've been doing comedy writing on, you know, television and stuff. So I'm like, wait, what's that about? You have a new life. Tell me about that. So yeah, with each new adventure, I'm down to, you know, share and keep talking. And for me, it's really just all about making sure that sort of making the improv world smaller. I want us all to connect. I want us all to be friends. And I want us to unite so that we can convince the rest of the world that improv is the art form that will sort of save our souls a little bit, makes us a little kinder to each other, allows us to collaborate in a way that doesn't feel competitive. It's just, it's a good thing. And I think everyone needs it.
I will totally tell you when I'm going back to Taiwan to maybe give some more workshops, because I've worked with clowns there and that was an experience on its own.
Wow.
Making the improv world smaller and smaller.
Absolutely. Oh my God. Well, thank you, Mario. Enjoy the rest of your day and I appreciate you being on the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.